Thank you for taking the time to listen or download this podcast from The Aimless Wanderer. If you would like to find out more information about the narrator and writer of this piece, Adam R. Matthews, please go to his website, aimlesswanderer.org. The Hungarian Referendum. It was May 2006 and I had a crisp TEFL certificate in my rucksack, an EU passport in my back pocket. I was off to discover the continent. First stop, Budapest. I came for 3 months and stayed for the next 2.5 years. That first summer, I spent my nights at the backpack hostel in a 10-bed dormitory under a wall-sized painting of Ganesh, the Indian elephant god, or on a mattress beside the counter if I got chance during the 14-hour night shifts of manning the desk and the bar. The 20th of August is Hungary's National Day, a commemoration of the first Catholic king of the Magyar, Saint Stephen. I was on night shift that evening, the only one in a hostel full to bursting. Even the back garden tents were full. I persuaded almost everyone to go out that night to watch the fireworks by the side of the river. They started at 9. Precisely 5 minutes later, one of the biggest storms I've ever seen broke over the city. I watched the front door banging in the gales as, outside, the wind ripped trees from their roots and deposited them onto the streets. Half a mile away, they whipped up waves on the Danube so rough that boats collided. 5 people were killed. None of our residents, though, thankfully, who returned rather earlier than I'd hoped, each with tales of near misses, and proceeded to party until 5. I managed but a fitful doze before I had to get up again and tidy the hostel and get off to my other job. 5 hours of giving an intensive business English class. I found enough work to quit the hostel and moved into a one-person flat opposite a pub with a rocking horse above the door that flashed Christmas lights until the early hours. My ground floor window had bars like a prison. I was on the edge of the notorious 8th District. But the courtyard was pleasant enough, and after 3 months in a 10-person dorm, I was ready to be alone for a while. I listened to the BBC in those days, and just a week after leaving the hostel, the World Service was full of news from my new home city. The Prime Minister had admitted, on tape, to lying in the morning, lying in the afternoon, and lying in the evening, and people were taken to the streets. In Hungary, it turned out, it wasn't just the weather that was volatile. In the hours every week I would spend with students, who were only too keen to talk history and politics to a foreigner, I learnt why the protesters had tried to burn down the Hungarian television building. It was, it turns out, a reference to the 1956 uprising against the Soviets when their predecessors had taken control of the state-controlled radio building. They also told me how today's rioters had set fire to a water cannon, and later even stole a tank that had been part of the 50-year anniversary commemorations for 1956. That night, protesters barricaded the 6-lane Elizabeth Bridge right in the centre of Budapest and were finally dispersed in the small hours of the morning with a torrent of tear gas. I didn't hear how much tear gas was used from either the radio or from my students, but the receptionist at my language school. When she turned up for work the next morning, tears were streaming down her face at having to walk the 20 steps from the metro station to the school building. We, meanwhile, had escaped to the countryside that weekend, to the Őrség for a bike tour of old churches and potters. At one place, the owner was so happy to ply me with apple pálinka that I flew along on my bicycle afterwards, a rucksack of pottery on my back, straight into a ditch. I broke only a single 50 forint or 20 euro cent shot glass, but still that was me pretty much done for the day. So that night we went back to our 3-room bungalow, drank frutsch and talked. There was one man in those days to whom everyone I spoke was almost universally afraid. Viktor Orban. At that time, he was the leader of the opposition to a government that was pulling itself apart. He'd been prime minister before, once, but in those days the populace still had respect for the old Socialist Party and had voted him out after only one turn. Now he was riding a wave, making the most of the disarray in government while surfing the rising tide of nationalism which diverted his party from being young liberals to authoritarian nationalists. He may have bided his time, but at the next elections in 2010, Orban won with such a huge majority that his party, Fidesz, was able to rewrite the constitution again and again and again. He reduced the numbers of MPs by 2/3, allowed old kingdom Hungarians who still lived in Slovakia, Romania, Croatia to vote for the national parliament, and awarded the winning party at the next election a bonus 40 seats, or 20% of the total, of all those in the National Congress. With the aid of this bonus, Fidesz was able to regain its 2/3 majority the next time around in 2015, although a couple of by-election losses mean that they've now lost the ability to write any more constitutions. Yet the posters of a grinning Orban declaring only Fidesz and plastered all over the country showed just how quickly this European country had apparently fallen into a one-party state. The main opposition these days is the far-right Jobbik, and it is on their field of extreme nationalism that he is now fighting. Today, there are no more posters of a grinning Orban. They're not necessary given the lack of upcoming elections. So to fill this campaigning void, Orban's Fidesz has found a way to keep the populace busy with their political agenda. Next month, the country will hold a referendum on the question of whether the European Union should be able to mandate the obligatory resettlement of non-Hungarian citizens into Hungary without the approval of the National Assembly. It's not a question on which the government could really lose, something David Cameron might dare to dwell upon as he chooses which revolving door to take next. Yet the official campaigning has been one-sided and relentless. Every household has received a 20-page booklet entitled Send a Message That Brussels Can Understand, with UKIP-style pictures of lines of refugees, Hungarian armoured vehicles, the Nice lorry, and some formal-looking, if somewhat dubious, statistics about no-go zones and money. Opposite, a quote from Mr. Cameron about the need for Europe to have strong external borders. And this advertising isn't limited to the postal service. At metro stations, the blue billboards declare that in Libya alone more than 1 million people want to come to Europe. The precise endgame is still unclear, but my guess is it's about positioning Orban to take advantage of Brexit. There are many here that would like to follow Britain out of the front gate of Europe. But then there are ever more elaborate infrastructure schemes planned for Budapest and beyond. Outside the EU, from where would the financing come for the new museums on the city park? For the renovation of the Prime Minister's new residence in the Buddha Castle? Or for the millions that have to be siphoned off through anti-corruption funding? They'd have to look elsewhere. Most likely to Putin's Russia, which is already providing the funding, and everything else, for a new reactor at Hungary's only nuclear power plant in Pocs. This is where goings-on in Hungary, just as in Poland and elsewhere, will have such a huge impact on Britain as they try to worm themselves out of the Union's webs. The EU is not going to let Britain off lightly. They're going to want to make it as unattractive an option as possible to dissuade net beneficiaries and contributors alike from following Britain's lead. A Britain ruled largely by moronic public schoolboys, who have so few negotiators of their own that they've had to elicit help from the Commonwealth. What those boys and girls from Canada and Australia can hope to pull out of the hat is dubious, but I wish them all luck in the world. They're certainly going to need it.